From the Bog Side in Derry, Mary Nealis has been active in community work from the 1960s. When two of her sons, Donaha and John, were imprisoned in Long Cache during the blanket protest in the 1970s, she became active in the Relatives Action Committee, campaigning for prisoners' rights. In this episode of Guhuna Octua Hain, Voices of 81, she recounts her memories of visiting her sons in the H-blocks and the experiences that they, and many other families, went through at that time.
Well, a shoot started at the beginning. My son Donaha was arrested in March 1976. That was just after the British government had removed political status from prisoners convicted of political offences. I was absolutely new to this. I hadn't a clue. I mean, I didn't come from a Republican background, but so many young people were being arrested and were around his age. He was 18 in the street where I lived. You know, I wasn't alone, and 17, 18-year-olds being sent down into prison. So he was sent to Crumlin Road jail first, and Crumlin Road was bad enough. I found out, I can't remember now exactly how, the Prisoner Dependence Fund in Derry was great. They arranged buses because we had to travel from Derry to Belfast. And I had never been in Belfast. I think I hadn't been in Belfast in 1950 or something like that. I knew nothing about the city. And so it was great that we had the buses put on by the Prisoner Dependence Fund. You know, at the beginning, there wasn't that many of us going up on the buses, but as that year, 1976, progressed, you know, the buses began to fill up, and I began to meet all their mothers, sisters, wives of prisoners in the Crumlin Road. Crumlin Road was a culture shock. It was a shock, just let put that way. It wasn't even culture. It was a shock. It was just an old dungeon, and it was just horrible. And what sticks in my mind about the Crumlin Road was the jangling of keys. You know, the keys of prison officers, I think, used to do that deliberately, you know. Donaha then was sentenced in November 1976, and he was transferred to Long Cache, to the H-blocks. We relatives had heard rumours, nothing substantial, about the H-blocks and about Long Cache. But nothing prepared, certainly me, for Long Cache, nothing. When Donaha was sentenced, the first thing happened, immediately after he was sentenced, I was in the court. They took him away, and I had asked for a visit. And when they brought him back for the visit, that was in Crumlin Road, they had shaved his head, and they had cut it all in the process. You know, I was literally in shock about that. He was transferred then to Long Cache, and I think I went to visit. I'm not sure of the time lag, but I went to visit a couple of weeks later, and I remember vividly the first thing that I encountered about visiting, and all the other relatives, I think, as well, was that you had to hand in this permit that they sent out to you, and you had to read out your name and your address. And the first thing happened to me, anyhow, was when I stood Derry, the prison officers, the screws, immediately contradicted me and said, "You mean Londonderry?" And I said, "No, Derry." And then there's a big row started between me and them because I refused to say Londonderry. That was the first thing. Then you were taken to the prison and you went on a bus into a room. And this was the beginning in 1976. There was no chairs. You know, this was a small room. The first time I'm done, there was about 70 or 80 of us. Insane. Everybody was smoking. The room was filled with smoke because we were all nervous wrecks. So that was the very first thing happened. Prior to that, I went up on a visit with a local priest who was a friend of Donaha's. And it was an exercise in humiliation for both himself and myself because they kept us standing for about 5 hours. Standing, there were no seats. And then they came out and said, they called Dennis, it's called Nealis. And I came forward and they just said, "No visits for them naked boys," was what they said to me. So we didn't get any visits. And the priest, they really humiliated him that day. They treated him so badly. Remember the first time I saw Donaha coming out in that dread, they had to put on some sort of clothes. You should have seen us, the clothes. You had to go through a search to get into the visits, and the searches were also an exercise in degrading you and trying to take away your dignity. The searches in the Crumlin Road were bad enough, but the cooperation and the fact that we women had, you know, so much in common, going up to see her children, we decided that we wouldn't put up with the searches. Searches weren't really searches at all. They were, but Father Fall, he was a priest that we got to know later on, described as a sexual assault. And he was right, that's what they were. You know, they used to run their hands up your bra, feel down in between your legs. It was really a sexual assault when I think back on it now. And this went on for ages until one day when we were going up in the bus, we women decided that we would have had enough of this. And we decided we'd make a stand. So I remember as well going into search box and your woman went to put her hand up my jumper and I just said, "Dear, don't you do that." And she said to me, "Are you refusing to be searched?" And I said, "No, I'm refusing to be sexually degraded. That's what you're doing. This is a sexual assault." So she went out and she brought in a male prison officer. And he said to me, "You're refusing to be searched?" And I said, "No, I'm refusing to be sexually assaulted. That woman's been sexually assaulting me now since I started to come to this prison." And I said, you don't need to put your hands underneath my bra and feel my breast, you know, and that's the sort of things they were doing then. Well, that stopped that. That never happened after that. That was because the woman, all the women come behind me that day had done the same. But the searchers themselves in Longcash, there was I remember this woman in Longcash. She had her hair all rolled up in rolls. You know, the old date style, you see, I always wondered, was it a wig? They asked you these peculiar questions in this peculiar language and a peculiar tone of voice, which was, "Have you anything on your person?" Now, I don't know what that meant. You just nodded your head and said no. But one day she said to me, "Have you anything on your person?" I done the usual, "No, I haven't." And she said, "Well, listen, I'm going to ask you that again because I know." So they knew at that stage that practically all the woman relatives, wives, mothers, if we were smuggling and everything, if we could get our hands off, they just did to me, bring in the M60. I would have brought it in bits, and I think most women were doing those sort of things. It was the only way we could communicate. But that particular night, it was Christmas. I had a Turkish delight, and I had, you know, Turkish delight was square, and I had tobacco, and I wrapped them up in a stretch and seal, and I rolled the Turkish delight to make it like, you know, like a cylinder shape, you know. And I wrapped it up in the stretch and seam, and I put it where we had to put it, the places that we had to put because of the searches and because of taking away the toilets. But that day she knew, she told me that she'd bring in a doctor from Lisburn to give me an internal examination, because that's what they did. So she told me, "You have to give me what you have on your person." So I reached in and brought out, and I hoped it was the Turkish delight, but it was the tobacco. And she thought that was all I had. So when I went in to visit Donna, and then that was another problem. You sat across the table, maybe about 10 screws standing around you. That particular day I passed, I was able to get the Turkish delight, and he asked me what it was. And I said, "It's Turkish delight." He said, I don't know how they kept their sense of humour in the blocks. He said, "It's changed its shape since I was outside, you know." John then was arrested in 78. Things hadn't changed. In fact, things had got worse. 78 was a particularly difficult winter. I don't know whether anybody remembers it. Right? And by that time, the health of prisoners was deteriorating. We relatives were smuggling in vitamin tablets because I remember both John and Donna had scabs all over their mouths and their faces due to the deterioration in their health. The searches hadn't changed. The searches were getting worse. You know, women, I think relatives are just amazing because we always find ways around of trying to get what the prisoners needed. We were rapidly realising that this was a matter of life and death, the deterioration and the condition of those suffering. When they closed the toilets and we didn't know what to do with what we were trying to smuggle into the prisoners, some women said that there was such a thing as open crotch panties, knickers, no. So I never heard tell of them, you know. I was at an age where it was past that kind of thing. But we found a shop in Belfast. It was a sex shop, but we didn't know what sort of a shop it was. But three of us went down, and there was a wallpaper shop next door. I remember the woman came out and she looked at us. She obviously thought we were in the wrong shop. But we asked her, had she got knickers with holes in them? She said, oh, you mean open crotch panties? So they were a godsend because you could secrete what you were carrying and then you could slip it out during the visit. You know, I think it was half an hour you got for a visit. And the shock of, for many women, I'm sure people listening to me who went through this would understand what I'm saying, the shock of watching the deterioration in health, the shock of looking at your child, your husband, your son, whoever, your brother, whose hair was long and dirty and the scabs on their faces and them coloured and chalk white and black rings on their eyes. And I remember I used to sit in the visit, literally in shock, watching the lice crawling up Donahue's hair and John's hair. And the hostility, and it wasn't just hostility of prison officers, it was downright hatred. They hated us. Yeah, they hated the prisoners, but they hated us relatives too as well. And they made life as hard as it could for us. But little did we know, it was only in later years that you found out what the prisoners had to go through to give you that precious 30-minute visit and what they suffered for it. It was only for the comradeship of the relatives of other women, you know. And the fact that most of us were beginning to realise just what was going on in that place, Hitch Blocks as they call it. And the fact that the visits were such a precious time out of our lives, because our lives at that, my life anyway, revolved around the prison and my two sons there, and many mothers, more than two sons, and I met women who had three sons, and I met women who had sons in one case and Crumlin, and maybe a daughter in Armagh prison as well. But you went into the visit and you sat with a smile pasted on your face because it was, you were sitting looking at your child who never had, don't forget, they'd never seen themselves in all those years. They didn't know what they looked like. You're sitting looking at lice crawling up ahead, you know, and you're looking at the prison officers and grin. So Donahue was doing 16 years and John was doing 10. John was 17. John had just turned 17 when he was arrested. There wasn't any change. The change was that the Prisoner's Dependence Fund provided us with every kind of help that they could give us. We were an amazing group of women and men who raised funds for the buses and gave us all the help they could. At the beginning, I used to be scared. I really was scared of the prison officers. I really was. It was such an intimidating atmosphere during those visits. Even standing at the parcels office, you know, and fighting over the name, Derry, London Derry, you know, that petty kind of thing that was there, so petty. During the visit, you know, your conversation was so false, you know, because you couldn't say the things you wanted to say. I wanted to say to Donahue, I love you, and I'm looking. You know, so I'd been sitting and saying things like that. We're sending letters to America. I was been saying stupid things like that there, you know, because you couldn't really say, with so many screws around you, so much hostility, so much intimidation, that's what it was. I was trying to pass John a wee thing one day, I think he was trying to pass me, yes, was, and we got caught. And it was only 5 minutes sitting down. They dragged him literally out with whatever hair he had, and they practically threw me out, you know. But I remember I took a psychiatrist, a very well-known psychiatrist in Ireland, asked me, could I get him a visit? So I did, and Donahue, he came along with me to see Donahue. At that stage, in it was coming near, the talk of hunger strike was near at that stage, and they had started to put up beautiful pictures outside Long Cash, you know, pictures of South Sea Islands and palm trees and beaches and all that there. You only like this, you know, the psychology of their thinking, because you went inside to a hellhole, you know, and they had all these lovely pictures outside. So I took this guy up anyhow. Now, it was his visit, so I just sat silent and listened to him talking to my son. And it was a revelation to me because my son, while they hated us, and you could sense that hatred in there, that hostility, there was my son sort of saying, look, these guys are just doing the job. to the psychiatrist, who must have been thinking the same as me, as a scapegoat. You don't understand, they're doing their job. Prisoners didn't have any great animosity. They didn't have that kind of hatred. They didn't have it. They knew what they were in protest for. They knew what they were doing. But that psychiatrist, when he came outside after, when we came outside the prison and looked at all the lovely photographs of South Sea Island, says to me, he said, "Don't worry about your son." He said, "He knows exactly what he's doing. There's nothing wrong with his head." He said, "But look at the faces of those prison officers." I always remember him saying that. "They're the real prisoners in this place." That's what he said to me. So the prison visits were such a vital part of our lives, of keeping contact with them. And it really didn't matter after a while. You know, you get very hardened to the hatred and the hostility of the searchers, of the prison officers, no matter what nice language they used to you, you know. We organized ourselves, and what communication that was contained in the little comms that came out, I have kept a lot of them. We sent it out all over the world, so that wall of silence that was built around the hedge blocks was beginning to crack. But the prisoners paid a terrible price for it. And in some ways, I think relatives did as well. You know, mothers, sisters, wives. They were heartbroken. I think that, you know, we relatives had always to be a step ahead of them. We had to think of ways ourselves to be able to give the prisoners, you know, our own children or whatever, what they wanted. So they particularly concentrated on wives and mothers and sisters. So we set up the Relatives Action Committee, which was a great group of people, both all over the North. The Relatives Action Committees were just, and they were just ordinary women. You know, we weren't extraordinary, we were ordinary people. Just as it's not an afterthought, because I think of it often. There was a big group of us, you know, in Relatives Action Committee in Derry. It's amazing women, mothers, wives, sisters, whatever. They're all dead. A lot of them after the prison protest ended, after things got better, after the hunger strike. A lot of our Relatives Action Committee women took cancer, heart attacks. I think there's myself and one other woman left, and that's the rest, and they're all dead. You know, and you know, the prison protest took a toll of prisoners, it took a toll of relatives too as well, you know. The searches. I often wondered about how those women searches could go home and sleep in their beds at night, you know, poking women all day long, like trying to, using that sort of peculiar language, you know, looking at us as if we were dirt under their feet, because that was the way they looked at you. The visits to the prisoners wasn't just a visit. It was for all of us, it was learning. It was growing up. It was understanding for the first time, maybe in our lives, what it was, you know, to experience hatred and hostility, but also what it was to experience the courage of those young, mostly young men and women in prisons. The comradeship in the blocks, and our mad jail among the women, you know, that sustained them. You know, if ever there was an exercise, people should examine how people lived the way the hitch block and our mad woman prisoners lived during those years. You know, the comradeship, the way they learned from each other, the way they stood by each other. And that same comradeship was reflected among us relatives, you know. I got to know amazing women. I got to know courageous women. I got to know women who were strong and determined. I got to know what love was, you know, during visits and talking to people in buses and looking at mothers who were heartbroken, but who loved.